bringing emotional support animals on airplanes, that is a source of heated debate. As millions of Americans prepare to fly for the holidays, we're looking at what these emotional support animals do and what regulations exist around them. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Beginning today, Delta Airlines will no longer allow these animals on board flights that are longer than 8 hours, and all emotional support animals cannot be younger than 4 months old. So no puppies, no kitties. We're getting perspective on this from Dr. Christine Calder. She is an assistant clinical professor of veterinary behavior at the Mississippi State University College of Veterinary Medicine. She wrote a recent piece for The Conversation called Flying with Emotional Support Animals, The Ups and Downs of Life in Coach. Dr. Calder, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So help us put some definitions in place. What is an emotional support animal first, and how does it differ from a service animal?
An emotional support animal is an animal that that a person can have that is not necessarily there to help them with a particular task. They're just there for basically emotional support, whereas a service animal has a task that they have been trained for to assist that particular person.
Some people may think that emotional support animals aren't legitimate, that you can perhaps buy a vest online and you're a dog is suddenly an emotional support animal. Is there any truth to that?
Well, actually, there is truth to that. However, that is not what legally they are supposed to be able to do. Technically, to have an emotional support animal, you are supposed to have a prescription from a licensed health professional. However, many of the licensed health professionals do not want to write these scripts. And so there have been ways that people have gone around that by getting online, and you can pay a fee, answer a few questions from an online, basically an online questionnaire, and they will send you a letter pre-written for you. And so that's a little bit different than service animals, since those animals do require specialized training and whatnot to have that title, and therefore are protected under law.
And these emotional support animals are also registered on particular websites?
Technically there is not an official database, no.
Okay. Why is that? Or is there just not an official, that structure just doesn't exist yet?
Correct. There's just really no specific guidelines or standards for evaluating emotional support animals. So therefore, there really is not a database or really any way to check up on, is this truly an animal that this person needs for this particular situation?
Are emotional support animals protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Only in the terms of housing. So basically, what with these emotional support animals, they are protected under the Fair Housing Act, so that you can bring them into housing that may not allow animals, or you can have fees waived, deposits for living in that particular housing department or apartment, that type of thing.
So there seems to be a little bit more structure around housing, but when you look at transportation and particularly what the airlines have been doing, it seems a little bit more disjointed. We just saw the news out of Delta that they're putting stricter rules around emotional support animals. Do we know anything about what kinds of changes that are coming down the pipeline?
I don't know a whole lot. I think what's happening is they are really being very reactive and making these changes based upon experiences that have occurred. I know that they are banning them on the longer flights. And a lot of that has to come from the pushback from other people taking these flights, since there has been some incidents with bites and, different types of animals. I know they've put restrictions on what types of animals can fly now. They're trying to limit it to dogs and cats, although they are allowing horses still, since that miniature horses actually do fall under the ADA as far as a type of service animal. But they're really trying to limit it. The ADA actually limits service animals to dogs only.
Dr. Christine Calder Yes. is an assistant clinical professor of veterinary behavior at Mississippi State University. We're talking about the role of emotional support animals, the issues with traveling with such animals. Gathering your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Do you have an emotional support animal? Have you brought your animal on a flight? We want to hear from you. Do you think emotional support animals should be allowed on airplanes? Why or why not? And should there be stricter regulations? You can call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Calder, we've seen images out there of a duck, of a peacock, of things that you wouldn't expect to see walking down the aisle of an airplane. What is it like for these animals to be on these flights?
That is the question. You know, many of these animals, they really, you know, they are, a lot of them are pets. And some of these animals are not emotionally stable, or they may not have any kind of experience in these particular situations. You know, they also, just like people, have social stresses and can have emotional issues themselves, or problem behaviors. And so when we put them into these social settings and these enclosed spaces, that can be very traumatic for the animal. And sometimes it's difficult for people to recognize that in their own pets.
The CEO of United, Oscar Munoz, said that on one occasion the airline was asked to fly an emotional support animal for another emotional support animal, and it was a monkey and a dog, and he didn't know who was supporting who there. And American allows miniature horses, but not goats or ferrets. So what kind of issues perhaps would be presented on a flight with these animals?
You know, it really depends, which is one of the reasons why the AAVMA pushed back so hard on the form that these airlines tried to have veterinarians sign, you know, that would guarantee the behavior of a particular animal. And it's really hard to guarantee a behavior in any animal in any situation, especially in a situation where there are multiple people in enclosed areas. That can be just very stressful. And so, you know, I worry about some of these animals and what could happen in that particular situation.
We've seen such an uptick of these animals on flights. Delta says it's carrying about 700 emotional support animals a day. Why do you see this upward trend? Where is this coming from?
Well, I think part of it is that airlines, hotels, they're afraid to deny these animals, and they're afraid to ask the questions, because legally they are allowed to ask a question of, you know, does your animal, what tasks does your animal perform for you? They can't ask, you know, why they have the animal. They can't ask for a diagnosis, but they can ask what task. And I think many are afraid to do that because of the legal system. And therefore, you know, they are pretty compliant about letting these animals on board. Also,
I'm going to have you pause right there. We're talking about the issues surrounding emotional support animals on airplanes. Some worry that these animals will be mixed up with service animals, and airlines could ban animals altogether, and those who sincerely need assistance will no longer be able to get it. Veterinarian Christine Calder is watching this. She stays with us. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Have you been on a flight where another passenger brought their animal on board? What was that like? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. Delta Airlines says it's protecting the rights of customers with documented needs, such as veterans with disabilities who travel with trained service and support animals. Delta just put stricter rules in place today for flying with emotional support animals. We're talking about these animals here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Veterinarian Christine Calder is an assistant professor of veterinary behavior at Mississippi State, and she wrote a piece in The Conversation about support animals on planes. We're gathering your insights as well at 800-642-1234. Do you have an emotional support animal? Have you brought your animal on a flight? We want to hear from you. Do you think emotional support animals should be allowed with air travelers? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Calder, Heather from Franklin called in to ask if allergies have become an issue when they're in a small area with these animals.
Yes, I do believe that is an issue. Many people are allergic to pets, and especially to the dander. And so when you have them on a plane with a very closed air system, there is an increased incidence or chance for allergies related to those pets on that airline.
What kind of benefits do emotional support animals provide their owners?
Well, they do provide them with, if we look at the human-animal bond, there is a lot of documented benefits to having pets. It lowers blood pressure. It increases social interactions. They help them learn how to focus or care for someone other than themselves. So, emotional support animals do have a lot of benefits for people.
Do they have specific enhancements that are more beneficial than regular pets? Like, what distinguishes them from a regular pet?
There really is nothing that distinguishes them from a regular pet. It's the service animals that do. The service animals, many of them are purposely bred and raised to be service animals. They've gone through a pretty extensive socialization program. They go through some pretty extensive training, but emotional support animals, there is no requirements for that. And so there is no difference between an emotional support animal and a pet.
Let's bring in Brian with a comment. Brian from Rochester, Minnesota. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes, so my comment is, I'm just trying to think about the scenario as far as like me sitting on the plane, next to or even just down the aisle from somebody who brings on an emotional support pet or animal. And I'm just wondering if they should be flying at all if they need that emotional support of a four-legged friend. And I ask that because, given any scenario, what if something does happen to their emotional support animal? And then now what? Now they're way up in the air, and now their support system is taken out of service, so to speak. And now what? If it's that important for them to be flying with, now what?
Brian, thanks for the call. What is your take on that, Dr. Calder?
I think that's a very good question. what if something were to happen? I mean, this is an animal that they depend on or feel that they depend on this animal in order to fly. And if something were to happen, I do wonder, what the effects would be on that person.
Dr. Calder, this kind of gets into the weeds a bit, but what happens if that emotional support animal needs to go to the bathroom? Because Delta here has banned them on flights that are longer than 8 hours, but some pets need to go before 8 hours.
You are correct, and that is another good question. I know many of the airports now have specific areas in the terminals for these animals to relieve themselves before flights, but you're correct. If they're on longer flights, what does that mean? We have areas for humans, but we don't have areas for these pets to go if they need to be on the flight for a long period of time.
Have veterinary schools been able to train veterinarians at all in ways to consult pet owners who have emotional support animals, and what guidance are they giving them?
Really, we don't have any guidance to give them. We do have some of the veterinary schools have human-animal bond departments, and they do. So some of the students do get experience with that. But really, it's not a subject that is commonly spoken about, even in the veterinary schools.
Do you expect there would be a backlash from people with emotional support animals over airlines making stricter rules like what we've seen out of Delta? What do you expect the response to be?
I do think there would be some backlash from people with emotional support animals, because they do feel, you know, these animals do provide some psychiatric relief for them. And I do think that, you know, they feel that they have a right to be able to fly these animals with them. And so that's something that, you know, I guess we're going to have to see what happens.
So are these animals at a person's feet? Where do these animals sit or stay?
My understanding is they are supposed to be at their feet, and not in their, they may be able to ride in their lap, but not in their own seat.
We saw this image of a duck with a diaper. is that something that is humane?
Well, that is the question. I think, you know, it depends on that duck and how they feel about that diaper. I mean, you know, we don't really know. I mean, if that duck is used to wearing that diaper, then I don't think that it is inhumane for that duck. But it could be stressful for them just having something different on them.
Let's bring in John now, joining us from Richland Center. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I am a survivor of a severe traumatic brain injury to my head, and I need a support animal, and I have one. But what does it take to get certified and accepted for an emotional support pet?
John, thanks so much for the question. Dr. Calder.
Hi, John. I think what I would say that legally the best thing would be to have a letter from your healthcare professional that states you need a prescription for your emotional support animal, and legally that is going to give you the best coverage for that particular animal.
John, thanks so much for the question. Dr. Calder, what would you advise federal regulators at the Department of Transportation and airlines? What would you advise them to do as their next step around emotional support animals?
I think what we need to do is get some more clear, specific guidelines or standards for these animals so that everybody is on the same page.
So how do you see them perhaps interfering with service animals? Is there a conflict there?
There is a conflict there, and I think that what can happen is, unfortunately, by having these emotional support animals, we can cause people to have a bad opinion of the emotional or of the service animals, and therefore they could wind up starting to get declined. And these animals, service animals, are trained to do a specific task for that particular person. And so they are really essential for that particular person to be able to go out in public, to fly, you know, hotels, ride in taxi cars. And without that animal, then they're not able to get out and about into the world and do, you know, normal things. And so I am concerned that having these untrained emotional support animals are, one, not only not beneficial to the animal, but could affect the service animals and their reputations.
Let's bring in Aaron now, joining us from Washington County. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program. I manage apartments, and I see this emotional support pet thing as a loophole to not pay pet fees and to allow pets where pets aren't allowed. They find it's like the dogs aren't allowed at the apartment. They find the doctor to sign off on their dog that they already have. It happens immediately. Like, emotional support dog is allowed, and then they're allowed in without any questions.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Dr. Calder, is this, do we see this?
We do. We do see this frequently, yes.
And so what is the remedy there? What should we do in terms of housing?
The best thing really is to verify that that is a letter from their physician and not one that they purchased online.
Erin, thanks so much for the call. Dr. Calder, what should you do if you're a passenger next to an emotional support animal?
The best thing to do is do not interact with that animal. You know, with animals, making direct eye contact, trying to touch them can be very stressful for that animal, and it can trigger a negative emotional response in that animal. And so oftentimes it's best just to sit and really do not try to interact with that animal just because we just don't know what the behavior is of that particular pet. And that way everybody is going to stay safe and be more comfortable.
Well, Dr. Calder, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Christine Calder is an assistant clinical professor of veterinary behavior at the Mississippi State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Coming up, we continue this conversation with a look at what it takes to train service animals. And we have a very special guest in the studio who knows what it takes to be a service dog because he is one. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this month, we saw the images and story of Sully, the yellow lab service dog to former President George H.W. Bush. And there's this picture of Sully lying in front of the casket with his head down. We're learning about service dogs here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Academy for Graduate Service Dogs, or WAGS, is a nonprofit that's been training service dogs and placing them with clients with physical disabilities for the past 31 years. Erin Backer is Executive Director of WAGS, and Erin is here in studio with Ian, a golden retriever that serves as Erin's demo service dog. Erin and Ian, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having both of us.
So Ian is at your feet.
Yep, that's where he usually is.
And the first thing that when he came in, he was really looking for you for that eye contact,
yeah.
Really wanting to know what's going on here. Is that true?
Yeah, that's what he's been trained to do. He knows that I have treats, so that helps a little bit too. But he's usually watching me, wanting to know where I'm going, and he's going to be right next to me.
And really paying attention to your cues.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, he didn't make it as a service dog for a client of ours, but he always had the ability to be a service dog. And that was one of his things. He was always focused on me, would do anything I asked him to do at the drop of a hat, and do it well and do it quickly.
We just learned how emotional support animals are different from service and mm-hmm. therapy animals, and mm-hmm. it really boils down to the notion that emotional support animals aren't required to get the same
Correct.
Training as service animals, and there aren't these legal protections in place. What kind mm-hmm. of training do service animals receive? How do they get trained up?
Well, we start with them as soon as we can get them out of the litter. So 8 weeks old, they start training. And that's working on basic skills, sit, down, heel, but also taking them out in public right away so that they get a sense that this is where they're going to work in the future. Out in public where it can be stressful, where there's lots of things going on that could take their attention away from the person that they're working with, and just repetition, and being out in public and working under those conditions for about 2 years. We don't place them until they're about 2.5. So that's a long time to be working on those things.
And what are some of the skills that they're able to do for your clients?
Well, all of our clients, for the most part, with the exception of a couple people, are all in wheelchairs. So the main thing is that they can reach things that are out of reach for them, something that's up on the counter or on the floor. They can open and close doors. They can turn on and off light switches. They can help them get their clothes on and off. They're there for emergencies. They can retrieve their cell phone or press a panic button. We've even trained some dogs, not all of them, to let themselves out of the house so they can alert a neighbor that the person needs help. So the other thing is constant companionship, always there when they need them. helping them in social situations. So they do a lot of things we don't train them for, provide comfort, like things like that.
As I was preparing for this interview, I found a statistic out there recently from University of Arizona saying, you know, half of the dogs that we start training don't end up making it as service animals, and they become, you know, these really well-trained pets. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Half may not make it through the program.
Yeah, that's the national average. The larger the group, you're going to be around 50%. WAGs, on the other hand, we're a smaller group. We have 12 to 15 dogs at one time. Our placement rate is about 70%. So 7 out of every 10 dog. Now, the three that don't make it, maybe they'll take on a lesser kind of role as a service dog. We have a home helpmate. This is a dog maybe for an elderly person that's not going to be out in the community a whole lot and works for the person in the home. All of our dogs can work in a home setting because it's not a stressful place. That's where they live and eat and sleep, and so they can do everything they need to do at home.
Oh, it's a really predictable environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And then maybe we have one of those 10 that just for some reason or many reasons can't make it at all, and it'll be a nicely trained pet.
What skill is the hardest for these dogs to learn?
They all can learn the skills. That part is easy. The most important thing for a service dog is temperament. A service dog has to be nearly perfect when it comes to temperament. They have to go into situations like an airport or a grocery store and be calm, but also confident. And that's very hard for most dogs.
We're talking with Aaron Backer, who is executive director of WAGS. That's a nonprofit that trains and provides service dogs for people with physical disabilities. We're learning about these highly specialized dogs that can perform a wide variety of tasks for their human. Ian is here as well this morning in the studio. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you rely on a service animal? How does it assist you? And what would your life be like without your service animal? You can call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Now, Aaron, when I think of a service animal, I immediately think of a lab or a golden retriever. Mm-hmm. Are these typically the dogs that are in service roles?
Most of them are. Now, there's also psychiatric service dogs that's a category of service dog that's really exploded. And for the most part, that can be any type or size of dog. But for dogs like ours that are doing tasks like opening heavy doors or getting up on counters or, you know, in an emergency, maybe pulling the wheelchair, they need to be big, strong dogs. And it's very rare you meet a golden or a lab that isn't friendly. And for the most part, goldens have really nice temperaments.
Where are people with service animals allowed to take these animals?
They can take them just about anywhere. The only places that they're really restricted are churches or private clubs like a golf club. Pretty much everywhere else they can go. And I've never been to a church that they've said, no, you can't have your dog here. Always been welcome in churches. So for the most part, they can go just about anywhere.
How much of temperament is just how the dog is born innate, yeah, and how much of that is training, learned?
Most of it's innate. The dog either has it or doesn't have it. Now, you can work around the edges of a temperament that's not quite perfect, but if the dog is not calm in public, there's really not much you can do. And that means it barks at other dogs, or it's trying to tell you that it's not comfortable by panting or making noises. That's just not a good temperament. That's not a good situation to put a dog like that in.
How long might these dogs be in service? For instance, Sully, President mm-hmm. Bush's dog, is 2 and mm-hmm. will go on to another veteran.
Yeah.
How long can they be in service?
Well, as long as they're healthy. You know, Ian here is 11, and he's shown me no indications that he's ready to stop working, which is wonderful. But we've certainly had dogs at 11 that were ready to retire because they can't do the physical tasks that they were always able to do, like getting up on counters. That's really hard on the hips, especially for goldens that, unfortunately, their hips go before anything else goes. So 11 or 12 is about the time, if they've stayed healthy, that they'll stop working.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Dale joining us from Oconomowoc. Hi, Dale.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
We have a dog from WAC that did not make it to the program. And, wow, she just came to us fully trained. And the kids just thought it was amazing that the dog could, you know, high five and nudge doors open and close, tug your socks off. And yeah. So I don't know what the situation was with this particular dog, but it did not make it through the program. However, they make excellent pets.
Dale, what is the name of your dog from Wegg's?
Gracie.
Gracie.
And she's almost 12 now.
Yeah, I was going to say 12 or 13.
Wow. Aaron, you remember these dogs very specifically.
Absolutely. Gracie was just before my time. Ian was the first dog I met when I came on board 10 years ago. But he's right. These are wonderful dogs. The reason that Gracie didn't make it probably was temperament a little bit, but wonderful around kids, fully trained. And what we do is we look for that wonderful family that will take care and love this dog for the rest of its life. And so that was a good match.
You know, I've seen statistics out there anywhere from $12,000 to train a service animal, mm-hmm. upwards to $50,000 to train a service animal. Mm-hmm. So talk about the cost.
Yeah, it can be very expensive. We have our dogs for about 2.5 years, and we pay for all the vet bills, of course, the emergency vet bills, which are really expensive, food, training supplies, treats. It does add up. It's probably for us somewhere around $12,000. If someone says $50,000, they're probably exaggerating a little bit, but that is very expensive, and that's why we're a small program. All of our trainers are volunteers. Nobody gets paid to do this work, because if they did, then that $12,000 would start really ballooning and getting higher, and we want to make sure we can place these dogs with people, and that to get a service dog isn't going to be a huge financial commitment. So we spend $12,000 to $15,000, and we sell them for about $5,000. Which is very affordable considering what else is out there.
How much of their day is spent in training then? How often are the volunteers working with these dogs?
Maybe just an hour and a day on skills. Again, that's the easy part. Most of it is taking them out in public, watching them work in public. When they do something good, you encourage that. When they do something bad, you try to eradicate that behavior. But just always watching them. And we wait till they're 2.5 because they go through adolescence, just like children. And that's when they really show you what their issues are going to be moving forward. And so it's working on those things as well as they get older and see how they change and how they react to things. So most of it is being out in public and just putting them through the paces and see how it goes and working on their things.
How can people in the public distinguish between an emotional support animal and a service animal?
Well, you know, honestly, emotional support animals should not be in public. They don't have that special right to be in public places. An emotional support animal only has the right to live in an apartment that has a no pet policy. That's it. Because again, these are pets and they usually have little or no training. So to put them into public situations like that is really not good for the dog, especially with no training as well. So all of our dogs have a Wags vest, a nice blue Wags vest. It has our logos on the side, so you can contact us if you see something or if you want to get involved with Wags. And our dogs that have been placed have a red Wags vest.
Aaron Backer stays with us. He heads up the nonprofit WAGS that trains and provides service dogs to people with disabilities. Your questions, your stories are welcome. 800-642-1234. Do you think people understand that you have a right to bring your service animal with you? Have you encountered issues accessing certain places? Has an uptick in emotional support animals made it harder for you to bring your service animal different places? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.
Taking a look at the WPR weather forecast.
Among the iconic images recently was that picture of President Bush lying in state at the Capitol with his service dog Sully in front of the casket. The 2-year-old lab retriever was loaned to President Bush by America's Vet Dogs. That's a nonprofit that trains and places service dogs with veterans. Sully opened and closed doors, was able to support President Bush when standing, and Sully also provided emotional support. We're talking about the role of service animals here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Aaron Backer stays with us. He heads up the organization WAGS, the Wisconsin Academy for Graduate Service Dogs. He's here with his demo dog, Ian, who was on this program back in 2014 with Joy Cardine, and Ian is no stranger to the studio. You can join in 800-640 1-800-942-1234. What would your life be like without your service animal? And what questions do you have about service animals? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Aaron, Ian can do lots of different things, but you're going to be able to demonstrate one thing for us. What is that?
Well, whenever I do a demonstration, especially for kids, I tell them that Ian can pick up anything that fits in his mouth, and I always like to drop a dime on the floor, and he can pick that up really quickly. Take it. It's rolling on the floor.
It's rolling on the floor, but Ian scurries and... See, I can't see over there. I can just see his big back. He's like a bear. He's so big. He's trying. He's trying.
Of course, we practiced it, and he did it in 2 seconds. But
and then, you know, when officially, when we're on the air, yeah, he'll get it, right?
But
he had it. Well, dimes are so small, and so he's actually putting the whole thing in his mouth.
Yeah, he's flicking it in his mouth with his tongue, something we've worked on a million times, but...
And so when they put things in their mouth, they can really use their tongue as dexterity?
Yeah, so anything that's really small, they can flick into their mouth. You know, the thing that Ian's always struggled picking up is a cane, but he's never had any trouble with dimes or anything small like that, so...
How do they, when you place them with someone, how do they get to know the person they serve?
Yeah, one thing we make sure to do is make it a kind of a long process. They first come in to meet their dog, and then after that, the dog goes home with the trainer. And then over the course of 3 months, they start very basic training at our facility, and the dog always goes back home with the trainer. And then we move up to a couple times a week, maybe in their home, out in public. And at some point, the dog spends the weekend with the client. And then eventually, and it can take 9 months, eventually they will go home to live with the person, and that's their service dog.
Wow, that is a very careful ramp up.
Yeah, well, it's hard for the dog to switch and to go from someone that is not in a wheelchair to someone that is in a wheelchair. And, you know, sometimes a wheelchair is loud and they have to get used to that. Different living situation, different work setting. And so it can take a while.
And they have to learn to then shift their trust because they put so much trust in their original trainer, I would assume.
One of the first things I noticed working at WAGS, which was really wonderful, is even the first time one of our dogs meets their client, it's almost as if they understand completely what they've been trained to do, and this is the person that they're going to be with, because they go over and jump kind of right up with their front paws on their lap in the wheelchair and lick them on the face or do something, you know, like that, and it's just wonderful to see.
Very warm and welcoming.
Yeah, and the person's been waiting a while, so it's kind of a, you know, it's for both of them, it's a really wonderful moment.
Let's bring in another call now. Let's go to Charmaine joining us from Burlington. Hi, Charmaine.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was just calling because I don't have a service animal or know anyone in my family, but I work in retail. And on a weekly basis, we have people come through. And the store that I work at is food and clothing and, you know, other products. But people come in with these small animals and they don't have a service jacket on. Or, you know, they let people pet them. And, you know, I'm saying, well, these aren't service animals. Why are we allowing them in? And, you know, it, as far as I'm concerned, it's ruining things like the airlines when the people are trying to take pets on the airlines and saying they're service animals and they're not.
So Charmaine is really concerned, Aaron, about you know, these emotional support animals having too much latitude, and the service animals who really need to perform specific things aren't, you know, get looked down upon.
Yeah, this is a very good point, because first of all, only people with disabilities have this special right to be able to take their dog in public. And then on the other hand, the people that have a service dog, it's their responsibility that the dog is well-trained, always under their control, doesn't bark, doesn't bother people. And so, you know, first of all, when people do this, it's not, you know, if they don't have a disability, they do not have the right to bring their dog into public places. And if their dog isn't under control and doing things that they shouldn't be doing, That can be really tough for business owners to be able to tell what is a service dog and what isn't a service dog. And, you know, they want to keep their customers safe, too. I'm sure that's an issue as well.
What is the protocol we should follow when we see a service dog or waiting in line or on the bus and there's a service animal next to us at our feet? What is our protocol?
Well, if the dog isn't performing a task at that time, absolutely ask the person if it's okay to pet their service dog. Because one of the wonderful things about this relationship, and our clients tell us this all the time, these dogs break down that social barrier between people with disabilities and everybody else. Almost all the people that we've worked with tell a similar story that before they had a service dog, you know, they would be in public and maybe they couldn't open a door or something. They'd ask for help and the people would walk by like they didn't even hear them. Well, now they have a service dog and just walking down the street, people stop them. Is that your service dog? What does it do for you? And that's really beneficial.
How deep is your waiting list, or do you have a waiting list?
We have a waiting list. Yeah, we only have 7 or 8 dogs available every year, and so service dogs. Many people, they're more popular than they ever have been, and so we would like to have more dogs, but it's really difficult to find the people, the volunteers, to take a dog into their home, to take it to work just about every day, work on their training. Work on their socialization, and then of course they have to give the dog up. So it's a very, very special person that does this for us, and they're hard to find.
How many volunteers do you have?
Right now we have 11 volunteers that are actively training, we could use 20.
So you're able to, basically produce 7 or so a year that are fully trained and ready to go. Your waiting list is deep. How does your nonprofit work in order to find the funding to do this very specific type of work?
Well, that's my job, full-time fundraising. We do events. We write for grants, you know, the usual things that nonprofits do. Fortunately, being in business for 31 years, we have a really good reputation in the community. A lot of wonderful people in the community that give each and every year. And that's how we pay for our services, is all fundraising. So everybody is a volunteer at WAGS except for myself, fundraising, and my coworker, Sarah, who works with the trainers and works with the clients with their dogs.
We saw Delta now banning emotional support animals on flights that are more than 8 hours, and they also banning animals that are younger than 4 months, so no puppies. Is this a positive change for people who rely on service animals, or are you concerned about what these restrictions, where they may go?
No, I think the restrictions are good, because service dogs, well, you shouldn't have a 4-month-old service dog, but if you did, technically you could bring that dog on, and they can be on flights for more than 8 hours. Any other type of dog that's not a service dog shouldn't be on a flight at all. So I think the restrictions are a good thing, and they have to keep the passengers safe. And again, a plane would be a very stressful situation. So you could see a dog with a poor temperament and poor training doing something that, you know, biting or attacking, that would not be good.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And thanks so much for bringing in Ian.
You're welcome. Thanks for having WAGS.
Aaron Backer is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Academy for Graduate Service Dogs, also known as WAGS. WAGS is a nonprofit organization that trains and provides service dogs for people with physical disabilities. We've been talking about the role of service dogs and the impact of emotional support animals on planes. You're listening to this conversation here on the Ideas Network.